A certain man, Lazarus was ill. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This was the Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, saying, "Lord, the one whom you love is ill." When he heard this, Jesus said, "This illness isn't fatal. It's for the glory of God, so that God's Son can be glorified through it." Jesus loved Martha, her sister, and Lazarus. When he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed where he was. After 2 days, he said to his disciples, "Let's return to Judea again." The disciples replied, "Rabbi, the Jewish opposition wants to stone you, but you want to go back." Jesus answered, "Aren't there 12 hours in the day? Whoever walks in the day doesn't stumble because they see the light of the world. But whoever walks in the night does stumble because the light isn't in them." He continued, "Our friend Lazarus is sleeping, but I'm going in order to wake him up." The disciples said, "Lord, if he's sleeping, he will get well." They thought Jesus meant that Lazarus was in a deep sleep, but Jesus had spoken about Lazarus' death. Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus has died. For your sakes, I'm glad I wasn't there so that you can believe. Let's go to him." Then Thomas, the one called Didymus, said to the others and to the other disciples, "Let us go too, so that they may die with Jesus."
When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was a little less than 2 miles from Jerusalem. Many Jews had come to comfort Martha and Mary after their brother's death. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him, while Mary remained in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been there, my brother wouldn't have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask God, God will give you." Jesus told her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha replied, "I know that he will rise in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the light. Whoever believes in me will live, even though they die. Everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" She replied, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, God's Son, the one who is coming into the world." After she said this, she went and spoke privately to her sister Mary. "The teacher is here, and he's calling for you." When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to Jesus. He hadn't entered the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were comforting Mary in the house saw her get up quickly and leave, they followed her. They assumed she was going to mourn at the tomb. When Mary arrived where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died."
When Jesus saw her crying and the Jews who had come with her crying also, he was deeply disturbed and troubled. He asked, "Where have you laid them?" or him. They replied, "Lord, come and see." Jesus began to cry. The Jews said, "See how much he loved him." But some of them said, "He healed the eyes of the man born blind. He couldn't have kept Lazarus from dying." Jesus was deeply disturbed again when he came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone covered the entrance. Jesus said, "Remove the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said, "Lord, the smell will be awful. He's been dead for 4 days." Jesus replied, "Didn't I tell you that if you believe, you will see God's glory?" If they removed the stone, Jesus looked up and said, "Father, thank you for hearing me. I know you will always hear me. I say this for the benefit of the crowd standing here, so that they will believe that you sent me." Having said this, Jesus shouted with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his feet bound and his hands tied, and his face covered with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Untie him and let him go." Therefore, many of the Jews who came with Mary and saw what Jesus did believed in him.
Oak Church, will you pray with me? Resurrecting God, meet us here in this space. as we are in a season of drawing near to you in your perishing, let us draw near to you in our own. Amen. Well, good morning, Oak Church. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Garrett, and it is a joy and an honor to be here with you today. And I have some good news, and I have some bad news. The good news is that the writer of the Gospel of John, traditionally John the Apostle, is really good, especially in this chapter, at making some events that are mysterious really present to us and really available. The bad news is that today that's about death. And as I work as a hospital chaplain, so this isn't an entirely unfamiliar subject to me, but in my experience, it's not really something that grows tame the more often you get close to it. And I think that's probably true for most people in here. And for anyone who is maybe a little bit too young to register that, unfortunately, you will get there too at some point. And we all go through seasons of it seeming more distant, less distant. And I have to confess that this is a sermon that comes out of a place where my grandpa was just hospitalized not too long ago. And he's doing okay, but as I was writing this, it was just striking to me that in the midst of the work that I am doing, my personal life isn't insulated from that. That was true for Jesus too, I think. And so I was really inspired by a liturgy that comes from Every Moment Holy, which if you have gotten to see my coffee table or my workspace, it's pretty prominently displayed, and so it's a gift that I would like to share with you. But there's an exhortation to make space for speaking of dying that I would like to share a snippet of as we get started. Children of the living God, let us now speak of dying, and let us speak without fear, for we have already died with Christ, and our lives are not our own. Our dying is part of the story that God is telling to us and part of the story that God is telling through us. It is not a dark and hopeless word that we must take pains to skirt or mention only in hushed whispers lest our conversations grow awkward and uncomfortable. Rather, death is a present and unavoidable reality, and one through which we, the people of God, must learn to openly walk with one another. So let's walk together into this text. We come to the story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead as a sort of long pause in a really interesting liminal space in the gospel account. Because we meet a Jesus who has been taking refuge from his own death by sheltering across the Jordan River. I'll try not to linger too long in the context, but there's a lot of really lovely things that are happening. So go back and read it. Chapter 10 reminds us that this actually is the area where John the Baptist had been working out his own ministry during the time that he was alive, anticipating the Lamb who would take away the sins of the world, the Lamb who would be sacrificed for the sins of the world. And yet, while this is the place where Jesus is immersed at the moment, it's the place where he is explicitly going to avoid being killed. There's an odd tension of the fact that his role, his job, in some sense, is to die. And what he is doing in this moment is not dying. So we're left with an open question. When will death's time come? Again, a question I do not think is terribly unfamiliar for anybody who's shared love in this world. And so the answer for Jesus comes, as it comes for so many of us when we're thinking about death, with the death of someone that he loved. And so, interestingly, John decides that now is the time to be super artistic with everything that he's writing. And so, if you'll forgive me, I'm going to nerd out a little bit about the text. John's book contains a series of seven sign acts, which we are cued into the fact that one of these sign acts is about to happen by the language of chapter 10, where it says that John the Baptist, the person who was anticipating Jesus, did no signs, but that Jesus did perform signs. Up to that point in the book, he had performed six. This is the seventh, and the greatest, Something big is about to happen. And yet, we still step into a weird tension because John has also arranged the book such that there are 7 points where Jesus makes a bold I am declaration. I am the bread of life. I am the way, the truth, and the life, and so on. And we get to one of those today when Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. But this is only the 5th time that he's made a statement in the gospel. And so we're looking at John doing this work of art where he's saying that something is finished, something is completed, and yet there is something left undone. John, of course, has the benefit of hindsight. We have even more benefit of hindsight. He's told us his whole agenda in chapter 20. These are written for us to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through belief we may have life in his name. So even right now, he's giving us some sneak previews about what's about to happen. And he does it so quick and so effortlessly that if you blink, you might miss it. In verse 2, he talks about how Mary is the one who anointed Jesus' feet. We haven't read that passage yet. That's a passage that doesn't come up until the next chapter. He's also quick to set expectations. The visitors that are present in the story recall that Christ had just recently performed an unprecedented miracle by healing a man who was born blind. This is a story that is familiar to us as well from the lectionary. And so here we are 2,000 years later, immersed in the story of this tremendous author and theologian, and we are sitting in it as the story is somehow completed and yet ongoing. And it's for this reason that I'm trying to do something that I don't usually do, something that I think John is inviting us to do, to sit in the moment of grief and pain and sorrow, to be invited to allow that to take up space, because we already are able to have the confidence of the resurrection. We can speak boldly and brashly about death because we can take confidence in the resurrection, because we know that part of the story. John is not writing to us as people who are ignorant, as people with no hindsight, but as people who know this and so need an invitation to do something different. Feels a little bit weird to say that it's something different when, as I've mentioned, I am a hospital chaplain. But it's not easy work for any of us to do. And I don't really think that any amount of practice changes that. I mean, Jesus is the God of the universe, taken on flesh, and yet sitting in the space of the death of someone that he loved, Jesus wept. And more than wept, Jesus was troubled. The God of the universe in human form was distressed and troubled. So it's this Jesus who meets us where we are at. The story complete and yet ongoing, our lives complete in him and yet ongoing, this tale complete and yet ongoing. And we see the way that Jesus meets us where we are at, first by his interaction with Martha, who comes out quickly to greet him when she hears that he's on the way. And Jesus actually meets her as she is tempted to run straight past the moment that's happening. And that's not to talk down the part that Martha's playing at all. She, of course, leads off very quickly by affirming, Jesus, if you'd been here, you could have done something about this. True, Jesus acknowledged that to his disciples. He said, I'm glad that I wasn't there because of this. I'm going to have the chance to help you believe. But for Martha, that doesn't feel as great. There's more of an accusation there. You could have done something, and you chose not to. But even into that moment, she speaks another profound declaration of, God will give you anything that you ask. She knows that Jesus can resurrect people. The other Gospels have already mentioned that at previous points in his ministry, this is something that's happened. And as the Jews in the narrative said, he's done unprecedented miracles before. Well, all of the Jews at this time had heard of the miracle of resurrection happening in the Old Testament. This is something that they already have a context for, so why couldn't they expect Jesus to act in that way now? But in the midst of that, in the midst of her making this bold request, there are also these moments where she's sheltering her grief, sheltering her true feelings, I think, through a cloak of spiritual language, right? So Jesus responds to her request and says, I am the resurrection and the life. Because she first kind of ran off in a direction and said, I know that he'll be back someday. A really easy thing, I think, for us to get caught into, especially as this text is read at every funeral that I've ever been to, and probably most funerals that I have not been to. It's really easy to fast forward to the future. And Jesus says, no, that's not how we're going to do it. We're going to sit right here. Lazarus hadn't been resurrected yet. Jesus, obviously, had not died and been resurrected yet, and yet somehow he says, right now, I am the resurrection and the life. While your brother is yet in the tomb. Do you believe that? Can you find the courage in yourself to believe that Jesus is life when you are surrounded by death? I don't know if I always do. Actually, in fact, I know that I do not always. But Martha, in that moment, to her great credit, really does. Something in her changes, and she says, I believe. Not that she sticks around very long in that tension. It says that right after she made this declaration, she ran off to find Mary. I don't blame her. It's not a very comfortable space to be living in. But what a strange turn of events that is. Martha said directly to Jesus, God will give you anything you ask. Jesus says, true, and I'm the resurrection and the life, and I'm here for you and your family. And she believed that, but she didn't stay with that hope. She didn't press into it in that moment. She turned and left to get Mary. Mary, who greeted Jesus with the same words that Martha did. Lord, if you were here, my brother wouldn't be dead. It's an accusation. Again, Jesus, where were you? God, you're supposed to be everywhere. Where were you? To which Jesus says, nothing. He's stirred in his heart upon feeling her pain and the pain of these friends, and we are told that he is troubled. But he is not in a hurry to give her an answer. He's waited a handful of days at this point, and it doesn't seem like the waiting is done yet. And so I'm drawn back again to what Jesus says at the beginning of this passage. First, in verse 4, this sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. And then in verse 14, he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. Really lovely things to hear, that Jesus is thinking about the belief and the care of souls of others. Easy from my own comfortable perspective, thousands of years away from anything that happened in this story. And certainly, even early Christians treasured these writings and sayings as they were looking for something to hold on to in their own trials and tribulations. But I have to wonder, and I think the text wants us to wonder, where was Jesus? Where is this God that we say is everywhere? Where is he for days, only to show up and then feel the pain, and then feel the sorrow? And I wish that I had an answer for you. The only answer that I do have is that it is this God who we try to trust when we are afflicted, who took his time in coming close to Lazarus, who was intentionally slow in coming to Bethany, who is once again unhurried in sight of the coming resurrection. It is this God that we meet at the table where every week we receive Christ's death and where we rehearse Christ's death with him. It is this Christ who feels and who weeps and who sorrows and who laments with us and is not in a hurry, at least to our appearance, to change that, but a God who lingers. A God who doesn't have a trite answer for why we are suffering, but sometimes gives meaning to other people through it. I don't really love that. I don't love the thought that my pain and turmoil are tools or vessels for something else. And yet, how much room do I really get to complain knowing what's going to happen to Jesus in just a couple of weeks from this point? The same things that Christ experienced are, of course, the things that we experience. That's the point. That is the point. That this is a Christ, this is a God made flesh who laments and sorrows and weeps and grieves and yet believes. Believes with us and believes in us and believes through us. That by believing in him, we may have life in his name. May that be the God and may that be the Christ that you meet today here at this table that is extended to you and in the face of everyone that you go out to meet. A mysterious and strange Christ who breaks all of our paradigms, who breaks all of the rules about how we think that a God should act and often the rules about how we think we should act. But who feels it? Who feels what that expectation and that breach does and doesn't shy away? Pray with me. Lord Christ, as we meet you in this table of your death, so meet us in the resurrection life that we have access to every day. We give you humble thanks for the ways that you have opened up to us a new way forward, and yet a new way forward that requires us to linger with you in the places that we maybe rather wouldn't. Abide with us, stay with us. Amen.